OTEC is just another one of these baseload renewable power sources that's available in a certain band. And turns out a lot of that geographic band is highly dependent on the flow of marine diesel. They're burning diesel fuel, not even like petroleum. They're burning the worst of the worst using 70-year-old technology that is no longer manufactured. They can't get replacement parts, and it's just breaking down. And the logistics of getting oil to a lot of these places is driving the cost up. There's been a nice confluence of events in OTEC over the last 2 decades with the development of offshore oil and gas infrastructure. This offshore oil and gas infrastructure development has brought the costs of a lot of the components of OTEC, turbines, pumps, heat exchangers, larger and larger vessels down to the point where it is now competitive in a lot of these regions with oil and gas. And that means more plentiful energy for these regions, which of course means more human flourishing there.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 842738, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is Nathaniel Harmon. Nate is a chemical oceanographer and the CEO and co-founder of OceanBit. They're building ocean thermal energy conversion, or OTEC, technology to deliver 24/7 baseload power across the world. Bitcoin mining is also a key part of their technology stack. This was a fascinating conversation, and I know you're going to enjoy the heck out of it and learn a lot along the way. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast wherever you're listening and give this show a 5-star rating. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care, but I sure would appreciate it. Also, just a heads up that you can head to the show notes for links to discounts on the Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet from Bitbox Swiss and on 5G SIM cards from Cloaked Wireless that protect you from SIM swap attacks. The promo code for both is Walker. If you'd rather watch this show than listen, you can head to the show notes for links to watch on YouTube, Rumble, and now on Noster via Highlighter. But if you're like me and you prefer to just listen to your podcasts, I highly recommend you check out Fountain.fm. Not only can you send Bitcoin to your favorite podcasters to give value for value, but you can earn Bitcoin just for listening to this fucking podcast. And if you're already listening to the Bitcoin Podcast on Fountain, consider giving this show a boost or creating a clip of something you found interesting. Finally, if you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, hit me up on social media or through the website bitcoinpodcast.net. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with Nate Harmon. I started doing the, like, just the roll from the top things after it was kind of a meta podcast. I interviewed Peter McCormick, who I've just always really enjoyed. Like, his is still one of the, What Bitcoin Did is still one of the podcasts I listen to the most. And he was like, no, mate, you got to, my accent, my Peter imitation is terrible. I got to work on it. Like, no, mate, you got to roll from the start. You know, the pre-roll is the best part. And I was like, okay, I learned something new. You know, you just start talking and you see what happens. And sometimes you get some gems in there. But I was, as part of my preparation for this, I was watching your chat with Peter. It was from about a year ago, I think. And just fascinating stuff. It was a good primer on a lot of this, but also excited because a year is a long time in the Bitcoin space. A lot can be done there. So, Nate, excited to have you here today. Thanks for coming on another fucking Bitcoin podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, it's awesome. Thanks for having me. Really excited. Yeah, you know, besides Peter's, yours is great. But really, I'm just not, I don't know, I have too much work to do, and I rarely listen to too much outside of you two.
Wow, I'm honored that I'm included in that list with Peter. And
I found the same for myself because I early in the Bitcoin journey was like podcasts were hugely helpful for me because, you know, sometimes you read stuff and it's like, this is going over my head a bit and I want to hear somebody like explain it in more detail and I want to be able to be driving or doing whatever else I'm doing while that's happening. And so loved podcasts. And then the further along you get, it's like, I still mine fiat for a living. So this is, you know, this is my side hobby, which I enjoy very much. But fiat work is not always conducive to having podcasts in my ears. So I've had to cut down my consumption. And now I'm making one now too, in, you know, another fucking Bitcoin podcast. And so it's like, I still have my top ones. Like I love Peter's. I love Guy Swan's because he just reads literally everything. Preston Pish has his great like Bitcoin show on the Investors Podcast Network. But I've kind of tamed it down from the list that I had before to basically those ones that I at least are in my recurring cycle. But glad that you're on this one. You know, Bitcoin podcast number go up, I think, is a good thing. We need to saturate the podcast market and just really, really overwhelm all of the fiat monetary podcasts. I think that's the key to mass adoption.
Right.
I think maybe a good place to start out here. Let's start at the very beginning. And I like to ask a question that's pretty broad and you can take it any way you want to. There's no rules with it. But just quite simply, who are you and how did you get here today to be doing what you're doing?
Yeah. It's a great open-ended question. So my name is Nathaniel Harmon. I go by Nate. I am an oceanographer by training. So I study the ocean. In particular, I specialized in marine geology and geochemistry. So the things in the water that are not moving or moving by are not alive, right? So no biology. I'm not really a biological oceanographer. My wife is the biologist in the family. I am a chemical oceanographer. I did analytical chemistry, method development, process engineering, platform development. So, you know, autonomous in situ measurement platforms, buoys and whatnot. It's been a life, you know, multiple phases. At one point I was a scuba instructor, which is really where I fell in love with the ocean. I taught people how to dive in the Keys, and then moved out here to Hawaii with my wife, who at the time was a dolphin trainer. So we were, you know, a very ocean-centric couple. We met in the Keys, in the Florida Keys, and decided to move to Hawaii after about 3 months of being together. So it was a quick turnaround. We've been together ever since. We've been married now. She's going to kill me for forgetting how long. And we have one small child, and you're a father now too as well.
It's a trip. Having this little human running around all of a sudden, it's just this fully fledged person. And you're like, I'm just trying not to screw you up. You know, I'm just, you're who you are. And I'm going to do my best just to nurture that. But yeah, I'm very early in this journey. It's only 4 months for me. So I've got some learning to do still.
But not running around yet.
No, flipping over constantly. Oh yeah. And so it's like just constant rolling over, seems to really enjoy that. Smiles constantly, which is great. Finds everything hilarious. He's going to be a prankster and a joker, I think. That's the vibe I get from him.
I remember my daughter's first method of locomotion was the continuous turning over. And we would just see her rolling into the kitchen, rolling out of the kitchen, because she couldn't go forward and backward. It was just, you know, rolling over, over and over again. It was the silliest thing.
That's creative problem solving right there, though. It's like, can't figure out how to go forward. That's okay. I'll move side to side.
Yeah, you you have the tools in front of you. You only have a certain skill set, certain set of tools, and you got to figure out how to use those tools in a creative manner, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what Satoshi did.
And he did it quite well, apparently, because here we sit on another fucking Bitcoin podcast because as a direct or a, well, few orders down result of this guy, people, whoever, deciding to just make money. It's kind of wild. Like sometimes I sit back and think about it. I'm like, what would the world look like? What would like many of our lives look like if Bitcoin just didn't exist? If there was that vacuum, you know, what would all of us who are somehow involved in the Bitcoin space be doing? And it's kind of hard to imagine. I guess more of the same. Maybe some of us would have found tangential paths. Maybe somebody else would have come to market with some other sort of, you know, some other cryptocurrency. Maybe if Bitcoin wasn't the progenitor of all of this. I don't know.
That's always what I figure.
Wild thought experiment.
I always liken Bitcoin to a discovery rather than an invention. Like it was always out there. The tools to create it were always out there, but nobody had put them all together in the correct order. And somebody would have done it eventually, you know, realizing that the key, the thing that no one had tried, was to just disappear.
It's a thing that I think is almost, would be almost impossible for most people. Like that took a special type of person to be able to remain anonymous and then to completely pull back from it and truly disappear. And then to whatever he, she, they are doing now has not touched the coins. Maybe they're no longer alive. Who knows? But it's wild to think about. Like Bitcoin would not exist as it does today if Satoshi did not disappear. It's not possible for it to exist. That's a throat to choke. And as it is now, There is no throat to choke, which is wonderful because there's a lot of people who want to strangle it.
As the kid
that's turned with us.
Yeah,
you avoid a lot of regulatory problems by simply not existing. When we were in the hospital, you know, for the birth of our daughter, you know, the lady comes in and is like, "Oh, do you want me to fill out the Social Security form?" And I took a second. I was like, "Wait a second. Do I?" And I had to. So they said, this is a formality. There's no choice.
There kind of should be a choice, though. Social Security is such a weird thing because that system, like, we were never meant to use the Social Security number as our, like, de facto government identifier. That was never the idea. They just had no other system.
To the Social Security law, do not use this number for identification. It's
and then here we are now, however many years later. And it's like, nope, that's basically the one number that you need to be able to do anything and prove that you are a person, a citizen in the U.S. And of course, so that you can, you know, be taxed appropriately and such. But it's just so funny. It's kind of an example of a really good example of a temporary solution just becoming permanent because of inertia. And like we're not going back on that. And then meanwhile, it's just childishly easy to scam people out of their socials and get access to that. And you send it unencrypted so many times and it touches so many people. And it's like, oh God, this is a really terrible system. Like shockingly
it's just
terrible.
Floating out there for everybody.
Yeah. It's a mess. Well, now speaking of systems, if I may, I would love to kind of dive in a little bit and talk about systems involving the ocean. And I would like to talk about OTEC specifically, which is what you are passionate about, focused on, building a company around. Can you talk about OceanBit a little bit at maybe a high level in terms of what OTEC is, what it kind of enables, and then we can maybe get into some of the more nitty-gritty about it?
Sure. Yeah, so Ocean Thermal Energy Conversion, or OTEC, which I hate the acronym because it's not intuitive. So I'm trying to trying to start saying ocean thermal now, like geothermal, because that's essentially what it is. It's a, it's kind of an offshoot of geothermal, where instead of using the heat from the, you know, the coming up from, you know, the center of the planet, right? You're using the heat that's retained in the surface layer of the ocean. So, right, the sun shines on the ocean, gets nice and warm. Here in Hawaii, it's very warm all year round, right? No wetsuit required. I don't know, where are you located right now?
Oh, in just balmy Illinois. We'll just say Illinois generally. I've lived in a couple of places. I've lived out on the West Coast for a little bit, but I've somehow found my way back to the Midwest. I'm a small town Wisconsin guy, like very small town. That's why I'm still, you know, habit of drinking Miller Lite. I can't get around it. It's like my body requires it somehow. But yeah, Wisconsin and Illinois is where I've lived for most of my life. I've never been to Hawaii, and it is on my list of places I need to go, like, as soon as possible. It just looks too beautiful to ignore for too long.
Yeah, it's definitely a very special place. I mean, you know, we got warm water all year round, right? As does most of the tropics, and a lot of small island development states. And yeah, ocean thermal energy uses that difference in temperature between the warm surface water and deep cold water. You run what's called a Rankine cycle, so it's just like a steam engine. You're taking heat from one location and moving it to a heat sink, so the cold water. You're moving heat from the warm water to the cold water, which is mediated by a working fluid. So in our case, we use ammonia. It's the best for the particular temperature range. And you use the warm water of the surface to boil that ammonia, right? Turn it into a gas. That gas now flows through a turbine, which spins. Of course, you can extract electricity. Then you condense that gas back to a liquid using the cold water. And then you just pump that ammonia back to the warm water heat exchanger, and it just goes around and around and around in a big loop. So it's a, you know, a base load component, and we can go into that, you know, a little more later. It's a base load energy source, so it's available all year round, right? I don't have to wear a wetsuit in Hawaii, even on, you know, the coldest day of the year. That's energy. And there's a lot of places in the world right now that are hurting because of the uncertainty in the, you know, the cost of diesel fuel, you know, just the logistics of getting oil or diesel or coal to, you know, some of these far-flung places just drives that cost up. Here in Hawaii, we're paying 46 cents per kilowatt hour. Because we don't have that energy independence. And OTEC, Ocean Thermal, can provide that energy independence to a lot of places.
I appreciate the primer on it because you were the person who actually, when I started following you on Twitter, you were the one who introduced me to this concept. And I had looked into it back then. I don't even remember exactly when that was. But then have been looking into it more since. And it's really kind of fascinating. And it seems so, in a way, obvious and simple that you kind of say, well, wait a minute, why is nobody doing this? And I understand it, the technology itself has been around for like 100 years, something like that. Can you talk a little bit about, okay, this is a technology that's been around, I mean, for multiple generations. Why did it not find traction? What was the barrier to it that, like, it's been around for so long and it seems so obvious, especially for places like Hawaii, places in the tropics, places around the equator. Why did this not catch on?
Well, yeah, like you said, it's been around for, first conceptualized like 150 years ago, Jules Verne in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was the first real inspiration. Then the first plant was constructed in the 1930s. Of course, that was not great timing for alternative energy sources, right? I mean, there were, electric cars at the time. There was a big competition between electric vehicles at the time and, ICEs, internal combustion engines. And there were, there was a couple of massive oil discoveries in the Middle East, in the U.S., and that was the end of it, right? It's, I always liken fossil fuels to, fiat. You're borrowing against tomorrow for gains today. And that's kind of been the story of OTEC, is they've been competing with fossil fuels. The largest OTEC plant built to date was the 1 megawatt OTEC plant here in Hawaii. So, decent scale and floating ship conversion here in Hawaii. Deployed, everything went fine. And there was a project to build a 40 meg, right? The next step after the 1 megawatt OTEC plant was a 40 megawatt OTEC plant here in Hawaii. And that was done during the Carter administration, Jimmy Carter. And after Carter lost re-election, Reagan came, took all the solar panels off the White House roof. But he also cut funding for all the renewable energy projects that were going on. So it set us back, that one action set us back on solar, on wind, and, of course, on OTEC. It had that project gone through, which I have the copy of the full design study, engineering report, design study here. And these things only now exist in paper because it was done during the 80s. So I got this plan that they spent millions of dollars on, to develop, to go get the parts, to do the feasibility studies, the environmental impact studies, all ready to go. Reagan comes in and just chops its head off. And if that single decision hadn't been made, we would have OTEC all over the world right now, and I'd probably be working at some other OTEC company. It's just been, bad timing, right? Fossil fuels are great source of energy, right? They're super energy dense. They're transportable, right? Coal, you can just put coal in your pocket, light it on fire, and get energy. Oil is a liquid, so it's easy to transport. Natural gas is a little more difficult, but they're easily transportable. They're super energy dense. And most importantly, they're centralizable, right? So you can have centralized control over the flow of oil. Think, there's a couple of kingdoms located in the Middle East that are, petrostates, right? The United States is one of the top producers and exporters of fossil fuels. You've got a handful of super majors that essentially run the show, right? They influence, a handful of people sitting on the boards of these very few companies influence geopolitics. And I think it was like just a few days ago that there was a report about illegal collusion between all these companies and Saudi Arabia to keep the price up of oil today, which is, of course, one of the reasons we have this inflation problem. It turns out that it was collusion with just a couple of people.
And here we're talking, just to clarify, OPEC, not OTEC, which I think is another reason to maybe change the acronym. It's really too close to OPEC.
Right.
It can be too easily confused. But apologies for the interruption. Just wanted to clarify for the listener, OPEC colluding here, not OTEC.
And it's not OPEC. It's all of the U.S. companies, too.
Or was it?
Honestly, yeah, I'm curious on that, because I mean, this is the interesting thing. So I think that there is, if I talk about the Bitcoin space specifically, there is oftentimes a knee-jerk reaction to any sort of, quote, renewable or green energy. And that's because, obviously, there have been, we look at things like wind and solar, which have some massive drawbacks. If we talk about solar specifically, you're completely tied to the production of these, you know, rare earth metals that are dug up by literally children in, you know, in Africa. Like this is not a, it's an exploitative industry that has also been massively subsidized to even have a chance of existing because the economics didn't make sense. And I think there's this general knee-jerk reaction to anything that is deemed as green or renewable, again, to say that, this must just be another scam. But I think it'd be helpful. I'm curious, would you agree with the statement in general, more energy use, more energy abundance equals more prosperity and more human flourishing? Like, we should be trying to harness as much energy as possible. Statement you agree with?
100%. Okay.
I think that's important for people to realize as they're, if you're listening to this and thinking this is some other, you know, green tech, climate change, WEEF agenda scam, you're a person who believes that we should harness as much energy as we can, that is good for human flourishing. And with ocean thermal, you see, and not to put words in your mouth, but an opportunity to harness a massive amount of completely untapped energy. Can you maybe expand that a little bit? Because I think it's important for Bitcoiners who maybe are looking at anything renewable and saying, okay, I'm not falling for this one again.
Yeah, I mean, it's like most renewables, they are location specific. You know, geothermal only exists where you have, geothermal available. You can't just, I mean, I guess you could drill down farther, but there's economic problems with that. You can't just build a river where one was not. You can move a river, but there's consequences. So with a lot of baseload renewable energy sources, they're only available where they're available. And this is even inclusive of nuclear as well. You need massive amounts of cooling water for nuclear power. And that's just simply not available. You also need, restrictions on, you have fallout zones, like nuclear doesn't work for Hawaii. And OTEC is just another one of these baseload renewable power sources that's available in a certain band, geographic band. And turns out a lot of that geographic band is highly dependent on the flow of marine diesel. And, they're burning diesel fuel, not even, like petroleum. They're burning the worst of the worst, using 70-year-old technology that is no longer manufactured. They can't get replacement parts, and it's just breaking down. And the logistics of getting oil to a lot of these places is driving the cost up. And there's been a nice confluence of events in OTEC over the last 2 decades with the development of offshore oil and gas infrastructure. So that, and this offshore oil and gas infrastructure development has brought the costs of a lot of the components of OTEC, turbines, pumps, heat exchangers, larger and larger vessels, down to the point where it is now competitive in a lot of these regions with oil and gas. And that means cheaper, more plentiful energy for these regions, which of course means more human flourishing there.
I appreciate the clarification on that, because again, for folks that are listening or watching, I think it's important to take a step back, to check our biases at the door when we encounter new things. And this is one of those things where, again, I I don't see a ton of reasons to be anti ocean thermal. Are there, I guess, what are, if any, what are the common pushbacks that you encounter when you're raising this topic? What do people bring up as why I don't like this, or why it won't work, or why we should forget about ocean thermal?
Well, it's been proven for almost 100 years now. 1931 was the first plant built, so there's no question whether it works or not. There's always been a question of the cost, but that's simply a matter of production capacity, economies of scale, which luckily, like I just said, with advancements in offshore oil and gas, some of those gains have already been made in production capacity, economies of scale, right? We can buy for our first commercial development, we're just going to buy off-the-shelf components, things, HDPE extrusion pipes, these turbines exist, large-scale water pumps, ammonia systems. Every ice cream refrigeration facility is using an ammonia refrigeration system, which is just an ammonia Rankine cycle run in reverse. And in fact, for our R&D facility, we're going to run a ammonia compressor in reverse because it's cheaper than getting a custom turbine made. It's cost. The environmental impact is extremely minimal. You're pumping cold water up to the surface. Of course, anytime you have a large piece of equipment in the ocean, you're going to have some impact, but it's, rather than a wind turbine or wave buoys, they're, singular. So they only have, one mooring system rather than dozens and dozens and dozens of mooring systems driving multiple piles, causing, massive amounts of sound pollution. There's a lot of the problems in offshore renewables are avoided with OTEC. And, it's fairly benign. It has almost no carbon, virtually zero carbon emissions, and it can be run carbon negative. You can produce, CO2, marine CDR, marine carbon dioxide removal, just by harnessing the deep water, the nutrients in your deep water. So there's really not that many objections. Altering fishing patterns is one thing, but of course you put something big in the ocean, fish are attracted to it. So it becomes an easier spot to fish. And really, the environmental impacts, our numerical modeler, Dr. Gerard Niehaus, had done, large-scale global couple climate modeling on this and found that it's not really until you get to the, 5 to 8 terawatt range for electricity production that you start altering, the thermal structure of the ocean and then cooling it, right? Which is kind of the direction you would want to go, because I don't know if you've seen this year, but it's been a absolute scorcher. We're breaking records, Six Sigma above the average. It's been absolutely brutal, but I look at the sea surface temperatures just straight mooning, and I go, well, that improves the efficiency of OTEC. So 5 terawatts of electricity is more electricity consumption than all of humanity uses today. So it's there's a lot of potential and very little drawback. You can build it with off-the-shelf components, so it's not like you have to create a new industry. You're just outside of titanium, it's steel. We have plenty of sources of steel, and I think Norway just found a massive titanium deposit. So I think the price of titanium is going to come down, which is Always a good thing.
Speaking of good things, it's always a good idea to review your Bitcoin security setup and upgrade it with the latest and greatest open source hardware. Head to bitbox.swiss/walker and use promo code WALKER for 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own self-custody. The Bitbox O2 is seriously easy as hell to use, whether you are brand new to Bitcoin, just starting out, or you're a seasoned psychopath and maybe you already have a few hardware wallets. Again, it is fully open source. You can head to their GitHub and verify for yourself. Please do not just trust me. Plus, when you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code WALKER, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this fucking podcast. So thank you. Now, I appreciate that because, again, it seems that so much of this, so much of the pushback is, again, cost-driven. It's about the economic feasibility of this. Like with so many projects that involve harnessing energy in stranded or in isolated places where there is a potential energy abundance, but because the location is isolated, because perhaps the population around it is small and also perhaps not having a ton of, you know, capital to invest in this themselves, it requires external investment. And that external investment says, well, when am I going to see a return on my investment? Well, you know, obviously, what's in it for me? Is this going to make money? And it seems that now this is kind of this... this beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that you have now a new way of making these sorts of projects not just viable but profitable. Yeah. where you no longer need to justify, well, you're going to be spending however many millions, billions of dollars, and we can't exactly say how many years until you start to see a return on that, but we swear it's coming. It's like, no. We'll plug in some miners and get it going from day one. So I would love maybe, perhaps before we get into the Bitcoin side of things, can you talk a little bit about where OceanBit is at in this process? I know you're running kind of some proof of concepts, some pilots, but can you talk about that and what kind of the planned build out is for you guys in terms of what sorts of facilities, whether they be land based or floating and mobile. What does that look like? You mentioned already some of the inputs that are becoming more economical already, but where are you guys at right now as a company, as an organization, and what are you targeting in terms of actually starting to deploy this at scale? What does scale look like for OceanBit? And maybe is there, what kind of timeline are we talking about here?
Sure. So right now we are operating and executing on three major components of the business. So first is technical development of what we call demand response OTech, which is that coupling of not just Bitcoin mining, but high density compute in general. Like most companies, in the, you know, the mining space, we realized fairly early on that, you know, Bitcoin mining is just one type of, high density compute, and, you know, other options are supercomputing, large language model training, things that require purpose-built data centers. You can't just convert easily, plug in high density compute to an Amazon cloud server data center. Those are general purpose computing, general purpose cloud computing servers. But you really need to, you know, for high density compute, you have to custom build your HVAC system, custom build electricity distribution, and oftentimes build purpose built power plants, like all the supercomputers, Lawrence Livermore, at all the different national labs, they all have power plants built specifically for them. And so Bitcoin is just one flavor of that high density compute. So we're doing the technical development of demand response OTech, which is our patented coupling of high density compute with a low temperature heat engine, or in our case, OTEC. We are doing the technical qualification of our vessel design with we are working with one of the marine classification societies, DNV, on the technical qualification of our vessel design. So we're building vessels, repurposing, refitting existing vessels into power plants. And we're working on the technical qualification with DNV. You know, this is de-risking that, you know, for insurance purposes, for project financing purposes. And then we are now engaging in commercial development with our first 25 megawatt power plant. So we're, and I will let the, we have an agreement with a country. And I will let them, you know, I'm going to save the announcement for them once we finish the initial feasibility analysis. Yeah, so that's really where we are and what we're executing on at the moment.
That's quite incredible. I appreciate you keeping it close to the chest with the country. But, I'm just thinking, okay, it's tropical. Perhaps equatorial, given that that's a nice zone. I won't ask you to reveal anything else, but that's fascinating. And I think, you know, maybe I can ask this without giving anything away. Does the country involved also plan to utilize this OTEC generation for Bitcoin mining? Is that part of the plan that you guys are working on with this country? Or how does that work?
This will go back to, you know, demand response OTEC, demand response ocean thermal. The demand response or the Bitcoin mining component is a key piece in the economic and thermodynamic puzzle and electrical puzzle of our, you know, novel plantship designs. You know, I don't know if you've ever been in a Bitcoin mining data center. It's hot, right? So these computers put off quite a bit of heat that needs to be processed, needs to be dealt with. Well, since OTEC relies on a, you know, 30 degrees Celsius to 4.5 degrees Celsius delta T, difference in temperature between that warm surface water and the deep cold water, and the heat coming off the miners is about 50 degrees Celsius. We can reincorporate that heat back into the initial power generation cycle, so essentially getting change back. So we can produce a little bit more power. We can increase the, if you want to get, you know, go down the rabbit hole, we can increase the quality of the working fluid at the turbine outlet, which increases the lifespan of the turbine. Right, so it's a pure gas coming out. We get more energy, you know, better, more efficiency for the cycle. But it also serves, as a demand response mechanism. In order to respond to differences in load on a power plant, you know, we're able to cycle miners on and off at, within seconds rather than, you know, hours, right? If you want to turn on a natural gas simple cycle peaker plant, if it's not already spinning, it's going to take hours to turn on. If you're, you know, going from cold start on a diesel generator, it's going to take hours to start. Versus miners, right? They can, be shut off. I don't know if you've ever seen how to turn off a Bitcoin miner. It's not the best way to do it. You just kind of pull the plug out, right? There's no like on-off switch on it. Ideally, you want to suspend the mining process and you drop your, you know, usage down to like 0.4 watts, 0.4 0.4 kilowatts or something, and then you just pull the plug. But you still just pull the plug. You can turn these miners off in seconds. And so as a response mechanism to differences in end consumer consumption, that is a very powerful tool to balance out, supply and demand issues, right? If they need more power, we can turn the miners off, make that available almost instantly. If they need less power, we can turn miners on. And then the other interest, so that's the thermodynamic coupling, the electrical coupling, and then on a sort of OTEC unique aspect is that, I've mentioned that OTEC is base load power. But there's a little caveat there. It's only base load power based on the coldest day of the year. So, the coldest day of the year, right? If I have a 25 megawatt power purchase agreement, I need to be able to supply that 25 megawatts year round. The annual cycle and even the diurnal cycle, right? The water gets warmer during the day and in the summer, and it gets colder at night and during the winter. So in order to meet that power purchase agreement, I have to be able to generate 25 megawatts of power year round. And so that means that every other day of the year that's not the coldest day of the year, I'm actually generating more power than that power purchase agreement. In the past, Dr. Luis Vega, who's an advisor to our company and is the godfather of OTEC, also happens to be my neighbor. He had been able to negotiate a power purchase agreement for, that base load component based on the coldest day of the year, and then a variable intermittent rate on that excess energy that you produce every other day of the year. And one of the things that's never been really discussed in the literature around OTEC is the economic impact of having to sell during the summer 20% of your power production at, dog shit, 4 cents per kilowatt hour price. And so this is another way that Bitcoin mining plays a big role, because what we can do is we can stack just a little bit extra. So instead of having, 25 megawatts of power production on the coldest day of the year, in this particular case, we would have 27 point something megawatts available on the coldest day of the year. We have a data center running a bunch of miners, able to soak up that excess energy, and during the cold, during the winter time, winter in the tropics, it's slightly colder, right? But not
just
winter
a little bit
by
colder,
any stretch. You can run the miners underclock. So you have 100% of the miners running, underclocking them, so they're slightly more efficient. And then throughout the year, as the sea surface temperature heats up and you're producing more power, you can shift those miners from underclocking to overclocking throughout the year, so that the same number of miners can be run throughout the year, going from underclocking to overclocking. So you don't have anything sitting there idling, no dead weight. And then now, because you have that excess power, and you have a buyer for that power, rather than an intermittent rate, you can now negotiate a peaker rate. So not only can the OTEC plant function as a baseload production, but also in a peaker capacity, which is having more energy available for peaker capacity in the summer when it's, 40, when you're pushing 40 degrees Celsius, takes a lot of air conditioning, to deal with that. And of course, it's only getting hotter. This year has been absolutely brutal. So having that excess capacity that can be made available within seconds is very useful because now we can sell that at a peaker rate, that capacity if needed at a peaker capacity, which garners a much higher rate. So, you know, we're looking, targeting around, for our first power plant, roughly 20 cents per kilowatt hour on a first of its kind bill, which is damn good. And then, you know, using that Bitcoin mining stacked on top of that as our margin. So we're able to sell into a PPA at, you know, just about the LCOE, use the Bitcoin mining on top as margin. Then that's somewhere between 12 and 20% of the production. And then that capacity is available as peaker capacity, which gets, you know, upwards of 40, 50 cents per kilowatt hour. That's a lot. But it's a, you know, very useful function. Turning what once was an intermittent production, and most of the time it would just be thrown away. Now we're able to monetize that excess consumption and make it available for, you know, times of emergency. It's either you buy the peaker capacity or you have an entire grid blackout. That adds to grid reliability, and it's just an incredibly important function.
I love that. And I think this is such a fascinating rabbit hole. And again, I only found out about like what the hell OTEC was, even though it's been around for 100-150 years, whatever it is. I only found out about it because I started following you on Twitter and was like, OTEC, what the hell is that? You know, let me do some research on this. And again, it seems that it's such a beautifully simple solution. Like you're using a difference in temperature that in tropical zones always exists between the deep, deep cold water and the surface tropical temperature water where you can swim without a wetsuit year round, feels great. And I'm curious, for these miners, I would assume you're using immersion miners. Is that correct? And are there any additional benefits there? Like, are there any additional efficiencies that can be gained by using immersion miners versus, you know, a lot of, I've seen, I toured Riot's facility during BitBlock boom when I went there, and I got to see kind of the standard setup where they've got kind of the hot room in the middle of one of these, you know, massive racks. And boy, that room, it could have been a sauna. Like it was already hot because it's Texas. And I'm a northern climate guy. So I was not doing so well in the heat. I was a bit hungover too. So I was especially not doing well. But then we went into the immersion facility that they were building out there, and it was quiet and it was cool. And so are you guys using immersion miners? What does that look like? Anything interesting that's able to happen because of that immersion mining?
Yeah, that's the plan, is to use immersion mining, right? We're limited in space, right? We're on a vessel, so we have limited space. So we need to cram as much energy density into as small amount of space as possible. And so two-phase immersion is the highest energy density available. And it's a simpler system, you know, rather than right now, I think a lot of people are using single phase. But over time, you know, as these miners get more and more efficient, as you're able to put more and more power into each unit, you're going to inevitably have to move to two-phase immersion. And it's there's less pumps involved. It moves on its own, and it enables us to, like I said, with the thermodynamic coupling, dump that heat very efficiently back into the Rankine cycle itself. So when, you know, the miners boil the immersion fluid, it turns into a gas. Then you need a, you know, heat sink to condense it back to a liquid. And we can dump that right back, use the working fluid of the OTEC cycle power, power system to as that cold source. So we get that heat back into the power generation. At least that's the current plan. We will, you know, things could change, but that has been and is still the current thinking on there.
Okay, that's fascinating. And can you just kind of paint a picture of these vessels, like what they actually look like, what kind of rigging? I mean, I'm assuming you're dropping some piping really deep, really deep. So it's a lot of piping, presumably. But can you paint a little bit of a picture of what do these vessels, what will they look like? And what's kind of like how, just out of curiosity, how big of a crew do you need for these things? Are they pretty much stationary? Do they move around a little bit? What does the actual operation of one of these ocean thermal vessels look like?
Well, the vessels themselves are just repurposed container ships or bulk carriers or, you know, oil transport. Depending on, you know, the market at the time, you know, it's a very cyclical market on vessels. There's usually one type of vessel that is more expensive at any given time. And then the other ones are, you know, cheaper. It doesn't really matter. We just need a hull. So regardless of what vessel we would acquire, it would look like a container ship from the outside. And we're just going to hollow it out, stick a power plant. So from the outside, it's not going to really look like anything. It'll just look like a container ship without a bunch of containers on it. And then, yeah, so you have the vessel as top sides, having a, you know, big vessel, we can weight it, you know, we can ballast it so that it sits really, really low in the water, which improves the efficiency, cuts down on parasitics, parasitic dump, you know, load, things like pumps. The higher you have to pump water, the more energy it takes to pump that water, right? So if you have, you're pulling water into a vessel from outside and you're sitting 9 meters below the surface, you've got 9 meters of head available that you don't have to pump, right? So you want those heat exchangers, all that water to be as low as possible in the vessel because it increases efficiency. So that's helpful. For our initial vessel, we're going through the technical qualification on, we are considering a freestanding hybrid riser system. So there will be, you know, a mooring system and between 2 and 3, either 3.2 meter diameter pipes or 2 4-meter diameter HDPE rigid pipes, extending down from, you know, 30, 40 meters down to the 1,000 meters. Then there will be flexible piping from there that will, there'll be a valve that goes to flexible piping, which will then come up out of the, you know, from the surface and will actually, you know, come over the side of the vessel rather than having a gimbal or having to, drill through the hull. Hull penetrations are a big pain in the ass to get, insured, classed. So having them for the initial system, having them come up and over the side is, you know, going to cut down on costs, cut down on insurance costs, cut down on time, and make it easier to attach, detach for the initial deployments. I think that answered all those questions.
It's really, really cool. And I was kind of wondering, because I'm, you know, imagining like this pipe just coming right from the bottom of the ship. But obviously that doesn't make a lot of sense. Like if you get some really intense weather and you need to be able to presumably like drop that pipe and go, you don't want that thing to be actually. Yeah.
That's how, okay. In the past, that was the initial thought on, previous vessel designs of ours and of others. You can just, you have a gimbal system or just a, pass through, and it's absolutely possible. And your, HDPE is fairly flexible, even though it's rigid. So you've got, you've got wiggle room. And the two systems are really, because the vessel is so large, they would be uncoupled. They wouldn't be acting as a coupled system. So they'd be uncoupled, and you can handle large pipes coming through the, right through the hole.
Just, it's wild to think about this, the scale of this. And so, I mean, again, this seems like an idea whose time has come. But when I say whose time has come, the time has been here, but the economics have come, perhaps. It's finally at a place where, because of the component costs being reduced because of other factors, and then also because of the fact that Bitcoin exists, Bitcoin mining exists, the need for not just Bitcoin mining, but other really high density compute operations exists. This is kind of this beautiful confluence of factors that is like coming together. And again, it seems crazy to me that for all of the talk of climate change out there, that I don't hear more about OTEC. Like this is what kind of blows my mind, because again, once I learned about this, it seemed just like really obvious. Like, well, okay, cool. You're using the delta T, the difference in temperature, and you're, okay, is there a minimal ecological impact around? Yeah, probably. You're pumping a lot of water up and you're putting water back in. Okay. But these things, as you're building them, can be mobile. You can move to a spot where you're going to have the least amount of impact. But it just seems crazy to me. I mean, is there more coming out in, let's say, the mainstream scientific literature that is supporting OTEC? I'm going to start saying ocean thermal. I'll stop saying OTEC, I promise. But is there more that's starting to come out in favor of this, like a second, renaissance of this technology, where people are saying, hold on, it's been around for 100, 150 years. It now makes sense. Why aren't we trying to do this more at scale? I mean, are you guys one of the only companies, I would assume, focusing on this? Are there a lot that I'm not educated and I'm ignorant of these? I don't know. What does that landscape look like?
Yeah, the competitive landscape is really starting to pick up. There are a number of companies that are working in the space. There's Global OTEC is one. They're out of the UK. They're deploying, they're doing their technical qualification on a circular platform design right now. There is OTE Corporation. They have been working on a SBIR program. I think with the Army on that one, and there may be a plant in development with them. Mitsui, which is one of the largest shipping companies in the world, has been in the space, is starting to really ramp up their, involvement in the space. Shell has put some capital into a couple of companies, one out of companies and organizations out of India, a couple here, one here in Hawaii on the heat exchanger side. So Mackay, Shell has invested in one of an OTEC company out of Houston that's working on a multi-purpose offshore power station. So it incorporated solar, wind, wave, and OTEC, and I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, their focus is on subsea OTEC. So, mounting the OTEC to the sea floor rather than at the surface. There are the Koreans, the Japanese are ramping up their OTEC, and the Chinese as well. So the Chinese last year deployed a floating 20 kilowatt OTEC power plant. So that was their first OTEC deployment just last year. So it's, it feels like OTEC is at a inflection point right now. And, once the first power plant is built, there will be a gold rush. Once the first at-scale power plant has been built, it turns into just an absolute gold rush.
Are these other companies, organizations, nation states that are pursuing this right now, are they incorporating Bitcoin into their economic models like you guys are? Or is it some are, some aren't? I assume that China perhaps is not, given their stance on Bitcoin mining, at least publicly. But what does that look like? Are you guys unique in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what we brought to the table. Our unique innovation was that coupling of high-density compute with OTEC. We have the patent, we have the PCT patent that covers 140 countries or something. We've had discussions about incorporating our demand response IP into some of their economic models, and we'll see where that goes.
It's interesting because one would think that given the history of ocean thermal, and even though many of the component prices have become more economical, that there is still a huge kind of gap in capital to deal with here, and that what you guys are doing at OceanBit is uniquely positioned to address that gap, to actually make it not just like, oh, we need to subsidize the heck out of this thing, and then maybe in the future, once we've subsidized it for enough years, it'll be profitable enough for the free market to take over, which seems to be how as an American, the United States treats a lot of things. Like, that's how the United States treats solar, right? We're reviving these solar companies that went bankrupt however many years ago and bringing them back. And there's, I think, a lot of, anytime you involve large government subsidies, which get larger by the year thanks to inflation, there's a lot of potential for just corruption and mismanagement and misuse. And it's a market distortion. And so what I see from you guys is an opportunity to make ocean thermal genuinely make economic sense from the start without needing to ask for these subsidies, without needing to pump a bunch of taxpayer or printed money capital into this. It's like it actually makes economic sense to do this right now. And so I think that's beautiful. And again, it seems that
turn down any money, any subsidies.
Well, no. I mean, we're still in the fiat system, right? And if the fiat system wants to give you a subsidy, absolutely. But what I'm saying is it gives me a lot of hope in the economic model that you're discussing, that it actually does make sense. That if the government says, I want to hand you $1 billion, well, you know what? We're late stage fiat. Like, why not? Why not take it? But you don't need to. Like, you can actually make this work. And perhaps the subsidies would speed things along a little bit, and perhaps one could make an argument in favor of subsidies. I am generally against them at a principle level, but that being said, if late stage fiat wants to throw you a bone, you may as well chew. But it is what it is. But I think that this is just such a fascinating area again, and I'm curious if there are we've discussed a little bit like what is ocean thermal and kind of how it works and OceanBit's approach to it and Bitcoin mining, how that factors in. But are there some kind of second order potential effects of this? Like I know, desalination is going to be something that the world needs in the coming years, but it's incredibly expensive because it's incredibly energy intensive. Does ocean thermal help some of these things? Like, does it help speed along some of those or make them more economical? What are the other kind of pleasant unintended benefits of ocean thermal, maybe outside of just what it appears on the surface?
Yeah. What's really interesting about ocean thermal is that it's able to sort of hack these, these fundamental equations, right? On the both the desalination side and the carbon, carbon dioxide removal side. In order to, desalinate seawater, which, as you point out, is going to be as, water scarcity ramps up, it's getting hotter and hotter, especially at the equator. You're going to have water, increasing water scarcity. In order to desalinate water, you have to remove the salt content from it. And the only way to do that, because it's in solution, is to boil it. You just have to boil it. And so when you boil it, the water vapor rises up and the salt's left behind. So the equation is, you have your water, you have to add its water and salt, you have to add energy to the equation. Out comes, water vapor and solid salt. That's the equation, right? You have to put energy in there. OTEC gets around that particular equation through what we've been discussing has been a closed cycle configuration. There is a second way to run ocean thermal power plants, and that's called open cycle. And you use a flash evaporation process rather than having a working fluid, ammonia in our case, for the closed cycle. You use flash evaporation in a, you create a vacuum. You have a filter, large filter, fancy filter, but a filter. You create a vacuum. You run that, that warm water through the filter and into that vacuum chamber. That causes some of that water to flash evaporate on the spot, creating, right, you leave the salt behind, you leave a brine behind. So some portion of the warm water that you're running through the system flash evaporates. Then you can take that vapor, run it through a turbine, and then use the cold water to condense it back to a liquid. But now that liquid is, of course, fresh water. With open cycle, there's a different set of challenges, because it's been proven for a long time. Luis Vega, Dr. Vega, had built a 210 kilowatt open cycle power plant here in Hawaii back in the 80s. It was the first OTEC power plant connected to the grid. The difference really is in costs and of the size of certain components. So for closed cycle, you need large heat exchangers. No way to get around it. On the open cycle side, you need way less heat exchangers, but you need a giant turbine. Happens to be the low pressure side of a nuclear turbine. So if the nuclear industry is to ramp up, open cycle OTEC becomes far more viable. Right now it's hard to get your hands on one of those turbines, so our initial focus is on closed cycle because it's very simple. All the components are available. So it's an interesting dynamic where you can get both energy and desalinate water from the same system, right? Rather than having to put energy in, you get energy out and water. And this is, definitely very, very useful in a lot of small island developing states. And then on the MCDR front, right, carbon dioxide removal, the, you know, thermodynamic equation is you take fossil fuels, right, big chunk of hydrocarbon, you light that, hydrocarbon on fire with some oxygen, you produce, you know, outcomes energy and, you know, CO2, right? That's the equation. You hydrocarbon, oxygen, fire, outcomes energy, and CO2. So in order to get that CO2 from the atmosphere back into a, you know, more manageable form that can be stored, sequestered, for long periods of time, you have to reverse that equation, right? So you need to put energy into the system to pull that CO2 out of the air and then, you know, turn it into some, you know, more manageable form. That's an issue because as the energy transition ramps up and, you know, the CO2 in the atmosphere is going to just snowball, right? It's an exponential sort of equation where the more we burn, the longer it's going to continue to rise for, and, it's just compounding on itself. We're going to have to not only develop new energy sources to replace the aging fossil fuel infrastructure, plus more energy to, you know, keep humanity going, but we're also going to have to develop more energy sources and more power generation to remove CO2 to get us back to where, you know, today. So OTEC gets around this thermodynamic equation because that deep water that you're pulling up to condense the working fluid or that, that water vapor is highly nutrient dense. And you can harness those nutrients to grow, you know, phytoplankton. Those phytoplankton will uptake carbon from the atmosphere, and as they die and sink below the photic layer, they take that carbon with them, sequestering it for, you know, 1,000 years. Of course, depending on where you are in the thermohaline circulation, you know, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 years, which is valuable, right? And you have that cold water, you're using that cold water to produce power, so power comes out of the situation, out of the, you know, the system, but also on the back end, almost as, you know, for free, you can, you know, there's a little bit of tweaks you have to do. You have to increase the density by combining it with your warm water flow. You need to, introduce some turbulence into your return flow so that it mixes faster, so that the settling velocity, the settling plume settling depth, you know, where that deep water plume settles is still within the photic layer. But essentially you can, you know, with the right configuration, you can get that MCDR for free, which is, of course, a product. That you could sell carbon credits or, you know, renewable energy credits or whatever the system that's inevitably developed to help offset other emissions of other carbon-based power plants.
So that's really, again, I continue to be more and more fascinated by this because this seems to be a much like Bitcoin, a never-ending rabbit hole. And again, I think that it's really important. Like, I'm of the opinion that that pretty much everything is good for Bitcoin. And when I see Bitcoin being used in Bitcoin mining being used in new and innovative ways, I think that that's wonderful. And I don't care if that is being used in Texas to balance the load that ERCOT is dealing with, and to, you know, take some of those gas peaker plants owned by, I think a lot of them are owned by Buffett and Charlie Munger, rest in peace. And also deal with the fact that the sun sets at night and wind blowing is intermittent. I don't care if it's being used there or if it's being used to literally just handle excess power generated by the difference between the cold water at the bottom of the ocean and the warm water at the top. Like, I think that's just fascinating. And I think that the more ways that we find, because that's the beauty of Bitcoin mining, is it's like you just need power. You just need electricity. Yeah. And the more ways that we find to find these stranded areas of electricity, like, that's great for Bitcoin. And so, again, I think this is just, that's all it is, right? And we waste so much energy.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's just a tool. It's a new component of, of the grid stack. And it has use within the entire supply chain of, energy. The pipelines themselves that transport oil and gas throughout the country. There's wasted energy there. The awesome things that are being done with, methane flaring, which is very important, right? It was uneconomical to go in and cap that methane. Well, now there's an economic incentive to do that. The waste gas from landfills. There's just so many use cases to where, Bitcoin mining can be applied to, improve the grid in just a multitude of ways. It's a tool that you can use, that it's just a new tool that we have access to.
And it's quite a wonderful multi-tool at that. And I talked with Daniel Batten on this show about CH4 Capital. He's a fascinating guy, a lovely guy, and that was such an interesting conversation. And again, this is one of those cases where, as with ocean thermal, landfill gas mining, it's one of those things where it seems too good to be true. It seems like in the case of ocean thermal, like, you mean you're just dealing with a difference in temperature, and because of that, you can generate power, and that power can be actually financed by the build out of that power can be financed by Bitcoin mining. And with Daniel's case with landfill mining, it's like, you mean you can literally turn trash into treasure? You can literally take methane, which I think that everybody, no matter where you stand on the quote climate debate, I think that everybody can agree that they don't want to breathe methane. And like, if you say that, yeah, I want to breathe methane, that's great. Go stand in a landfill for a while, and then I'll believe you. Like, I don't think that anybody wants that. And it's, again, one of those things where I don't find very many, very many reasonable critiques to it. And again, I think that fossil fuels, as you pointed out earlier, are incredibly important because they're a super energy dense medium, right? They're incredibly energy dense. They have allowed us to, progress as a civilization to where we are right now. And through that, we're also able to build incredible pieces of machinery and all these other things that then enable us to explore other technologies like ocean thermal, which previously were not economical, but now are.
Look at it.
And I think that it's beautiful.
It like, renewables are low time preference versus fossil fuels are high time preference. They're fiat fuels, right? I mean, the U.S. dollar is propped up by, of course, oil, and the trade of oil in U.S. dollars. There's unintended consequences, right? Yeah, you're using that energy, today, but we're going to have, we're starting to see those effects of, 150 years of burning coal on, crop yields, right? Crop yields this year have been abysmal all over the world. Temperatures across the world are just, Six Sigma above what they, what the pre-industrial average is. This is the hot, 2023 was the hottest year we've ever recorded. Water scarcity issues are popping up all over. You're seeing massive, you know, floods, droughts. You're seeing, it's the result of, you know, centralized fuel source. And had, I always like to think about the, you know, the alternate universe of what if fossil fuels, we hadn't had access to, you know, easily accessible fossil fuels, and we were forced to develop society around alternative energy sources like, you know, hydropower, right? Where, you know, since we build cities, large societies around large sources of renewable energy, yeah, we would have, it would have taken longer to develop, but we wouldn't be, you know, it would be more, you know, it would be a more robust system to changes. You wouldn't be, you know, a lot of our agriculture, a lot of our, you know, infrastructure is built around stable climate. And we're jeopardizing that at the moment. And that's going to have, you know, adverse effects. You're going to see people having to move out of certain areas because they just become inhospitable. And you're already seeing this, you know, migrant crises all over the world are, you know, political instability caused by famine or drought, right? Those are, you know, first and second order effects. And I mean, this year has been, 2023 has just been, and when I say Six Sigma, that means that there is no ambiguity in that. Like, it's, you, there is no explanation. It's, I think it's like a, what is a Six Sigma? It's like one in so many billion chance. You know, it's how we determine if, you know, something is real or not, is how many, you know, how many orders of magnitude, how many standard deviations away we are. And, you know, I think Bitcoin is the key to this energy transition because it's uniquely suited for it, right? You know, with fossil fuel infrastructure, it's, you know, I'm going to simplify things here, but fossil fuel infrastructure in general, it's a low capital expense, high operational expense, right? It, you know, spinning up, trying to can build, you know, a bunch of coal power plants because they're generally pretty cheap to build. You know, we've built them for 100 years, the economies of scale exist, so you can build them cheap, but you have that additional cost that you need to acquire the fuel to burn, right? And so that's operational expense versus renewable infrastructure, you know, hydro dams, geothermal, nuclear, OTEC. These things are high capital expense, but relatively lower operational expense, right? It doesn't, once you build large scale renewable power plants, well, it costs nothing for the sun to shine. It costs nothing for the wind to blow. It costs nothing for the geo to therm. And, you know, it's that difference that, and you can't turn it off. Like if the sun is shining, or, you know, the river is flowing, it's really a use it or lose it sort of situation where, you know, you either have someone to use that energy or it's just wasted. You know, with fossil fuels, you simply just don't burn the excess fuel. That's the most economic solution, as, you know, with the halving and the hash price, you know, collapsing, you're going to end up with a, you know, each epoch that continues, that hash price is going to go further and further down. And eventually that operational expense of having to, you know, acquire that fossil fuels is never gonna, you know, never gonna pay for the mining itself. But if you have very low marginal cost solar or wind or, you know, geo, where, well, now it's essentially zero. If no one's going to buy it, it's zero. It has no cost to you. It's zero. So regardless of what the hash price is, Bitcoin mining has a incredibly important function in taking that curtailment and dealing with that curtailment and providing a revenue source to these, you know, renewable energy developers. And I think it's, you know, it's the key piece of the puzzle that's been missing is that, you know, how do you deal with curtailment?
And that's, again, where Bitcoin, as with ocean thermal or as with landfill gas mining, Bitcoin mining itself at times seems too good to be true, right? Because it's like, well, and I think that's where a lot of the skepticism comes in from the outside, where it's like, okay, yet you're saying Bitcoin fixes this and Bitcoin fixes that, and now you're saying Bitcoin mining fixes all of this and is our solution. But I think we're seeing the narrative shift. I think there's a palpable change in the palpable shift in the Overton window around Bitcoin mining, where the evidence is stacking up so much that it's becoming, I mean, just really an untenable position to hold that, well, Bitcoin is, you know, burning the planet or whatever. But I'm curious kind of what, from your perspective, like what is your, if you had to explain it, like I'm Elizabeth Warren, for example, how would you explain like the, what's your elevator pitch for ocean thermal plus Bitcoin equals good thing that you should support?
Yeah. 24/7 baseload renewable power with a demand response, a built-in demand response component for coastal communities and the blue economy.
I mean, I'm sold. You know, out of curiosity, because I think maybe you touched on this a little bit earlier, but just to make sure we drive it home, what are we actually talking about in terms of the scale of potential power generation for ocean thermal? Like what, to a layman, like what are we really talking about here in terms of numbers?
Yeah. So, I mean, the rate limiting step on ocean thermal power production is going to be the feedback, right? The cooling of the ocean, you know, the changing in the thermal structure of the ocean. And it's about 5 terawatts of electricity, which is just a mind-blowing amount.
That's so, and again, for the layman out there, including myself, typically we see like Bitcoin's energy consumption measured in terawatt hours, which is the amount of terawatts over the course of, like they typically average out, like this is how many terawatt hours it will use over 1 year. Can you equate that just again, for those of us who do not have these things sort of top of mind, that kind of look like?
So
fair, because I mean, I assume we're talking total number of hours in the year, amount of generation at any given time.
To get to terawatt hours per year, you know, terawatts is a unit of power. Terawatt hours is a unit of electricity. So, you know, you multiply terawatts by, 8,760, and you get, 44,000 terawatt hours or so, from, 5 terawatts times 8,760, 44,000 terawatt hours.
So wait, that's, if I'm correct, I think according to Cambridge, Cambridge's research, Bitcoin is like 150 terawatt hours, right, per year, something like that. I mean, so we're talking multiple orders of magnitude greater than the Bitcoin network. I mean, this is like an unfathomable amount of energy. I can't even say unfathomable right now. That's how unfathomable it is.
Yeah.
That's nuts. And it's, I mean, that's the crazy thing is it's just kind of like, it's just sitting there. Most of our planet is water, is salt water, you know, but it's all around us. And again, it's kind of one of those things where, I mean, I love an idea whose time has come. And I love the symbiosis of something like Ocean Thermal with Bitcoin, because it's incredible when one technology can make another actually viable. And it's this, you know, 100 years ago, of course, they couldn't have conceived that something like Bitcoin was going to come along and change this equation of economic viability. But now here we sit at this really fascinating time. And to think as well about the second and third order effects of this sort of technology, and how, I mean, so much, there are a lot of people living in tropical climates and equatorially that can genuinely benefit from this, and that can drive down their cost of energy, i.e. their cost of living, because energy is, that's the base component of most of every economy on the planet, right? What is your cost of energy? And to see that driven down by the natural resources that they have around them. And again, it's just like, what's your delta T? What's your change in temperature? I just think it's beautiful. It's beautiful to see.
Yeah. I'd appreciate that.
It's cool. And I'm curious. If somebody's listening to this and they're like, okay, this is really fucking cool. Are you guys, if you can talk about this, are you guys hiring? Are you still seeking investment? Anything like that for somebody who's like, I just think this is really cool and I want to drop what I'm doing and get involved in this somehow. Is there a way for them to do that?
Absolutely. On both of those accounts, we are, you can get in touch with me on Twitter, Nate Hawaii, on LinkedIn, Nathaniel Harmon, through our website. We have contact. Reach out if you have a skill set. And, that's how I met our co-founder, Sam Benson. He reached out after he heard one of our podcasts. And, we've been working together now with him for a year and a half. He's been kicking ass. And so we brought him on as a co-founder. And yeah, he'd manage vessels for TK. He'd overseen vessel conversions, vessel refits for the Australian, Royal Australian Navy. He'd done system integrations on RVs, research vessels. He's like, I've been working in and around the ocean my whole life. And this is putting that together. So absolutely. If you have any sort of, technical skill set, business skill set, we can absolutely use your assistance.
That's awesome. I'll link your Twitter, of course, and the website in the show notes. I'm curious also, this is a completely unrelated topic, but are you reading anything right now that you would recommend for others to ingest?
Am I reading anything?
Fiction's fine too. Fiction. Go ahead with fiction if you've got it.
I read a lot of scientific papers, so.
Fair. That makes sense. Yeah.
If I could recommend one book that really assisted me, I'm not currently reading it, but it would be Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. It's a monetary history of modern age, going back 350 years or so, looking at, the Bank of England, and just the movement of capital. It helps, when I first started learning about Bitcoin, I knew I had to go teach myself C++ to read the code, right? And if you're to understand monetary history, you need a good history lesson, where we came from and how we got to where we are today and the need for, Bitcoin. And yeah, capital in the 21st century, Thomas Piketty. It's heralded as one of the best economic books of the last 100 years. And then he has a follow-up, Capital and Ideology, which is, you know, how ideology influences the movement of capital throughout an even longer history period.
I haven't checked either of those out myself, so now I've got a couple of good recommendations to dig into. I appreciate
about
that.
About 900 pages of real thickness.
Wow. Okay. All right. So I got it. So it's a real dig in type of book. Well,
and it's the type of book where you need to use the web portal, which has, you know, the addendums, it's a real thick, it's a real thick read.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the warning in advance, just so we all know what we're prepared for. First of all, I appreciate you sharing your scarce time, because, you know, time is scarce, Bitcoin is scarce, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. And I appreciate you joining me on this one. Anything else to leave us with? Anything else that we failed to cover here today? Because, I mean, again, this is just fascinating, and I love what you guys are doing. I'm very certain it's going to be very successful, and I wish you the best of luck. But is there anything we failed to cover, or any parting words?
The ocean is life. We came from the ocean, and it holds the key to humanity's future. You know, we need to take care of it. We need to take care of the land as well. Yeah, try not to throw trash into the ocean.
This is good advice for everyone. Throw it into a landfill at least, so that Daniel Batten can mine Bitcoin with it. At least do that much. You'll be doing everyone a good service. Well, Nate, thank you so much for your time again. Appreciate it. Looking forward to seeing you in the flesh here, hopefully soon at some conference or another. But until then, thanks so much.
Awesome. Aloha.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor. If you're enjoying the Bitcoin podcast, consider giving a 5-star review wherever you listen, or sharing this show with your network. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care. You can find me on Noster by going to primal.net/walker. And if you want to follow the Bitcoin podcast on Twitter, go to @titcoinpodcast and @walkeramerica. You can also find the video version of this podcast at youtube.com/@walkeramerica and @walkeramerica on Rumble. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. Until next time, stay free.